Stay tuned for The Turning Point with Mike Fader. And this is Mike Fader. We are going to talk this morning about something which probably was inevitable, but it's really pretty bad news as far as I'm concerned. That there was an article in the paper the other day, and I'm sure that you've seen this in whatever your favorite media is to receive news, or I don't know if it's news, but at least information given to you by the government. U.S. troops sent to Syria to aid forces fighting ISIS. Deepening involvement, President orders commandos to advise local groups. And as you're all aware, the President Obama has announced on Friday that he'd ordered several dozen special operations troops into Syria for the first open-ended mission by the United States ground forces in that country. Deepening American involvement in a war he has tried to avoid for more than 4 years. White House officials said the troops would advise, remember that word from Vietnam, advisors, would advise local forces fighting the Islamic State and not play a direct combat role, of course. But they left open the possibility of sending more in the future. Oh, man, deja vu all over again. The escalation came just weeks after Russia inserted itself into the multi-sided civil war to support President al-Assad, bombing opposition forces, including some supported by the United States. And goes on to say that once intent on just using American air power to help local forces on the ground, Mr. Obama has now sent 3,500 American troops into Iraq, and an American soldier was killed on a commando raid last week. And of course, the White House says that the mission has not changed. Well, I think, what is the mission? What is the mission anyhow? Does this country even know what the mission is anymore? Do we know what the mission is? What is the mission over there? Anyhow, to help us sort this out and to answer some questions that come up, we have with us a guest, John Rainwater. Hi, you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being on. And John is the Executive Director of Peace Action West and the Peace Education Fund. And let me give people a brief idea of who you are. For over 25 years, John has been active in campaigns on issues of peace, nuclear disarmament, social justice, and environmental sustainability. And he's worked on issues, nuclear issues for Greenpeace, and he's advocated for victims of domestic violence for the California Alliance Against Domestic Violence. He's also been involved in the electoral arena and dozens of campaigns for progressive candidates and ballot measures. Before joining Peace Action West, he worked in the environmental field, hoping to pass groundbreaking legislation on global warming emissions and environmental justice in California. John Rainwater leads Peace Action West's efforts to stop the development of new nuclear weapons and the war in Iraq, the endless war in Iraq, and to promote diplomacy with Iran. Tell me about Peace Action West and the Peace Education Fund.
Well, Peace Action overall nationwide is the largest grassroots peace organization in the country, and basically we try to connect the activism of people at the grassroots and Peace Action affiliates across the country, including Peace Action West, with decision makers, so that when President Obama makes a decision to send more troops into Syria or to extend the war in Afghanistan, members of Congress hear about it, and the administration hears about it, and we can put pressure on our elected officials for a more peaceful foreign policy. So that's who we are. We work grassroots. We do direct lobbying in Washington, D.C. We do media, those sorts of things.
The mission is basically, what is the organization's mission, its prime mission, and maybe ancillary missions?
Our prime mission is to have U.S. foreign policy have a moral compass, you could say, to have a more peaceful foreign policy. And we work, as you mentioned, towards nuclear disarmament, particularly focused on U.S. policy around nuclear weapons, and to have the budget reflect moral priorities, too, and move away from funding Pentagon pork and moving money back into our communities. So those are the kind of things that our mission is focused on.
Where do you get your funding from?
Pretty much all small members. We don't get large foundation grants. The type of work that we do is somewhat controversial in terms of trying to stop these wars, and so it's all small donors.
It's an interesting world where it's controversial to stop a war, but
indeed.
That's controversial. how did you, obviously I've told people what your background is, but it seems almost inevitable that you'd wind up at Peace Action West, but how long have you been there?
I've been here over 10 years.
Okay. This is an extremely complicated situation over there. It's one that's maybe more difficult to follow than any other foreign policy problem or war or civil war that we've seen in maybe, I don't know when. I mean, there are so many players and so many people involved. Maybe what we could do is just kind of narrow things down by, like, asking questions. And I wrote an article on my website the other day just posing some questions, some rhetorical questions. But let's just sort of skip around a little bit. And if you want to put some order to it or bring something else up, feel free. would the United States have sent these troops in and increased its presence in Iraq? And inevitably, it's going to increase its presence in Syria. It's not just going to be 50 troops. We've seen this with Vietnam and every place else we've ever been since then. Would we have done this if Russia had not decided to join this battle?
I think it's possible that we might have. I mean, we were headed in that direction. I mean, one thing about this this contingent of 50 troops that I think is worth pointing out is that this is the fix to the failed arm and train policy, where we're going to arm and train the Syrian rebels. And I think, as your listeners probably know, that was a debacle. We were supposed to train thousands of troops, and we wound up spending millions of dollars for 60 quote-unquote moderate rebels. A lot of those rebels ran away from the battlefield. Some of the arms wound up in, you know, extremist fighters' hands. It was a complete disaster, and these 50 troops are supposed to sort of provide adult supervision. That's probably the wrong term, but one way.
I'm sure that's the way the administration in America,
that's the way they think of it.
Yeah.
It's kind of doubling down on a failed strategy. It didn't work to arm and train these rebels, which, you know, really aren't going to be effective, by being over the border. So now we're going to vet less these quote unquote moderate rebels. We're going to just vet the commanders and not the line troops. But we're going to have special forces on the ground to help coordinate things, which means being on the battlefield. The other day, Senator Tom Cotton, of all people, called the administration's bluff by pointing out that it sounded to call these troops not combat troops. He called it Orwellian. He cited George Orwell.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when Tom Cotton citing George Orwell about this, things have gotten pretty strange. So I think in some ways, because of the failure of the armed train program that went miserably, this might have happened anyway as an adjustment to that.
But it seems to me that could they really be that ignorant and that unaware of this failed policy? I mean, it failed in Afghanistan, and it continues to fail. Failed in Iraq and continues to fail. Why would they, and failed here, why would they believe that? That's what makes me suspect that these people, not being entirely stupid, that they wouldn't have asserted themselves so much. You know, if the American troops are there, their combat troops are on the ground, if some of them get killed, you know, there'll be all kinds of flag waving and screaming and yelling about how we have to avenge American honor and our troops, blah, blah, blah. And then it's an excuse. It's the inevitable excuse to send more people in. I know that. Do you really believe that they're just so ignorant that they would just proceed to back up a failed policy without some other plan or agenda?
Well, I think multiple things can be happening at once, and different actors can have different motives. So the scenario that you describe, I think, is definitely a possibility. And the fact that Russia is in there, you know, makes this particularly dangerous, because it could be Russian troops that are killing American special forces, and mm-hmm. that would trigger something even, you know, potentially more disastrous than just having U.S. special forces be killed in Syria. So I do think, however you look at it, it's a, even though it's quote-unquote only 50 troops, it's a major escalation, because it can spiral out of control. And are there people who want it to quote-unquote spiral out of control? That's a possibility. I try not to read the minds of some of these folks, but I think the scenario you describe is something to be extremely concerned about.
Well, there are people who are in Congress who seem to be interested in chaos, just pure chaos. I mean, sometimes it produces much more than anybody ever wanted, but there are certainly people who benefit from increased wars and increased conflicts. Clearly, there are weapons companies, the oil and gas. There's a lot of oil and gas in that area. I mean, it seems to me that there are people who would benefit from an increased, you know, military disturbance in that area in which we were involved, because we would have to. But I mean, do you think that it's inevitable? To me, it seems absolutely inevitable and maybe there is some plan to it, and maybe there isn't, or maybe both. It's inevitable that that this is going to escalate, that, you know, maybe there'll be thousands of troops there in a few months or more.
I think it's at least close to inevitable, and I think you can see a dynamic in Afghanistan that's pretty interesting, where you had an escalation up to 1,000 troops, or 100,000 U.S. troops, I should say. And then there was this drawdown, and the president made a promise to get out of Afghanistan, and Peace Action worked very hard to push Congress to press the administration to withdraw from Afghanistan. And we came close, but because of this logic of escalation, the Taliban's still in power 14 years later, and we can't get out. And so I think it's not necessarily a linear path, escalation always, but once you've committed to a military solution, it's very difficult to get to control the dynamic, at least when it comes to removing troops. So, you know, the troop levels can go up and they can go down, and I think, but with 50 heading to Syria, I think it's, you know, very high likelihood that it's going to go up in Syria, and it's going to go up in Iraq soon. I mean, we could have an announcement very soon, I think, of, you know, hundreds, if not more, thousands more troops heading to Iraq, and I think when a new president comes in, it's very likely that we'll have a lot more troops in Iraq and Syria.
Well, that might be an interesting way to segue into the next question. I mean, the new president, despite whatever Bernie Sanders is doing, the new president is almost inevitably going to be either Hillary Clinton or some Republican, who will be very aggressive. And Hillary Clinton is not known for her reticence to commit troops or to be aggressive in various areas. So I think that makes sense that probably that would happen, and we'd be embroiled in this again, which brings me around to a really important comment or question, and I'd be interested to hear what you have to say. I mean, it stopped a long time ago being the Army of the United States of America, and it has become, since they declared it to be a volunteer army after Vietnam, I think it was in 1974 when they changed that policy, somewhere around there, Nixon, before he was kicked out. Is it possible? I mean, it says very in the article, it says here that the president has sent 50 troops to, 50 special operations troops to Syria. The president this, the president has increased the United States, and if it says the United States, it's not. It's the president. He has a personal army. There is no say. It's part of this detachment that the people of the United States have from their own government, especially when it comes to who we're killing overseas.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And part of the tragedy here is that the people who are supposed to represent us in Congress, in this case in particular, don't even want to say. They've kind of refused to debate our activities over in Iraq and Syria, and the no boots on the ground pledge that was just broken with these 50 troops heading to Syria was used as an excuse for Congress not to debate the war, for Congress not to pass an authorization under the War Powers Act. So we've got a president who is able to deploy troops all over the country without any debate. For example, staying in Afghanistan, Congress didn't debate that. The American public didn't debate that. So I think that's a really huge problem. But the people that are supposed to be representing us aren't doing us any favors by not insisting upon a congressional debate about these wars.
Now, is the reason for that the same reason which it's impossible? I think, my opinion, it's impossible to be too cynical when you're talking about wars and risking soldiers' lives and American foreign policy and elections and power. The president's party is running for election next year for president, for many other offices, governors, senators, congresspeople, and these people are running. is it possible that he is doing this and he's been urged by his party to do this so that even before we come to, you know, the actual election, that the Democrats look, quote unquote, tough in the world?
I think that's a huge dynamic, and I think that's where the center of gravity is in the Democratic Party, is to be tough on defense, and I think that's a big part of it. I do think that there is some war weariness in the American public, and there is a, you know, a potential to backfire on these things, and that's why they try to ramp things up slowly. That's why I assume that the no boots on the ground pledge was made at the beginning of the war, was to not offend that element of the American body politic. So I think they're trying to do a delicate dance here of remaining tough on defense, and I frankly think that's the ideology of some of the people that run the foreign policy apparatus. I mean, I think, you know, when Hillary Clinton talks about a no-fly zone, which would be incredibly destabilizing, and is really a misnomer to think of that as protecting people. The humanitarian groups, the human rights groups, do not like these so-called safe zones that aren't negotiated by the warring parties, because they can be, you know, people rush to them and actually can harm more civilians that way. But even though it was a disaster in Libya, Clinton supported it. You have people like Robert Gates and Susan Rice writing articles about how we need to escalate in Syria. So I just think that's how the foreign policy establishment thinks. But I do think that there is a chunk of the Democratic base and really some independents that is war-weary and cynical also about these wars, and they have to be careful about that. And that's part of our job, is to mobilize those people to speak out and say, we're not going to vote for you, we're not going to donate to you, we're not going to go out and walk precincts if you support some of these wars. It's a tough job, but we have to use what leverage we have.
Well, I suppose, and you've mentioned this a couple of times, about that's what the that's what one of the practical interests of your group is, Peace Action West. You're listening to John Rainwater, who is executive director of Peace Action West and the Peace Education Fund. Really, I understand that you're working as hard as you can and you're lobbying people, but does it seem as if it makes any, I mean, if you say that the people who are supposed to, even liberal people in Congress or moderate people who are in the Democratic Party, if they aren't really even debating what's going on here, and this is the same thing that happened in Vietnam. I mean, I'm 70 years old, and, you know, I saw this, you know, as it happened in real time, if you could call that real time anymore after what was going on. I mean, you know, first it was first there was a presence we didn't even know about. That's in a, that always happens. It was the CIA, right, and whatever covert special operations troops in Vietnam. And I'm sure that's happened even before the president has sent these people. There are CIA.
Oh, absolutely. You know. They've been there for a while in Syria.
Sure. And I'm sure they're, I mean, last I read, they were over in something like 140 different locations and countries throughout the world. You know, it's covert or, you know, overt. Is that a word? But what makes Peace Action, aside from hopefulness and the desire to do something, because we're still Americans, what makes you think that you're dealing with people here who will even bother to listen if they're not even going to debate the issue in public?
Well, I think politicians want to get reelected, and you can only push the electorate so far, and you can see in, you know, leaks and thing, you know, things like that, that politicians do worry about where the voters are. It doesn't mean that they worry in a kind of civics class pure sort of a way, but it's something to be reckoned with. And so I do think that we had success, for example, and just like in the environmental field, success is reversible, in getting most of the troops pulled out of Afghanistan. We went from having 100,000 troops in Afghanistan to having less than 10,000 troops. Now, we thought we were going to succeed in pulling all of them out, and we now have to put pressure on Congress to pull all of them out. But we all know that the military really wanted tens of thousands, many more troops. So I'm not as cynical in terms of feeling like we don't have any impact. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a fair amount of evidence that there was a real battle over, were we going to have 50,000 troops in Afghanistan, 10,000, none. I think the public comes into play. So we don't get to call the shots. Foreign policy doesn't look anything like people like you and I want it to look like. It looks the opposite in a lot of ways. But the public is still a force to be reckon with as one thing to manage, put it that way, and I think that gives us some leverage. Something else we're working on now that I think can get through regardless of what goes on in terms of the intentions around the military fight is to increase funding for humanitarian aid for the millions of refugees over in the region. There's a bill in Congress right now that would increase humanitarian aid by $1 billion. That doesn't run head first into the military industrial complex, but it's something we can advocate for mm-hmm. and get done that, you know, you can look at it as putting a Band-Aid on the wound, and it's certainly not dealing with the root causes of the military industrial complex, but it is dealing with the war in a direct way if you're one of those people who's been displaced, who's starving. And so those are some of the other things that we advocate for. So I think there's a lot we can do. We've cut nuclear funds. We've stopped specific weapons programs. We're not transforming, you know, foreign policy overnight, just like we're not ending global warming overnight, but mm-hmm. we are having an impact in that way.
What are the... Well, I mean, that's good, and you can only hope that it gets better. One of the things that seems to have disappeared as an effective tool, as an extremely effective tool, almost disappeared entirely, and you can almost track how and why it did, although I can't understand completely the reasons, but I sort of can, is that during the Vietnam War, the war was, in the beginning, it was, you know, there were lies involved, the Gulf of Tonkin and everything else. And then, you know, it was that leftover Dulles stuff that if Vietnam falls, whatever they thought Vietnam was, you know, then the communists would take over all of Asia, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And maybe the Russians or the Chinese. There was a time when there were two, and this is a two-pronged question, and yeah. You can answer both. The press was a lot yep. freer to report and decide and investigate. What changed with the press was that in the first Iraq War in 1991 with George Bush's father, that's when yep. they started embedding, or as Amy Goodman, I think, once said, you know, having the press go be in bed with the military, right? You know, embedding. Yep. That's when, remember, Norman Schwarzkopf would get all the press together hundreds of miles from anything resembling yep. a battle or a war scene and tell them what was going on, and they printed that as news. That was the beginning of the end as far as press freedom goes. But I remember in Vietnam, there were a lot of people, but many people, even in the mainstream press, who managed to find their way into places and to see what was really going on, A. B, demonstrations, you know, freedom of assembly is a basic American right, but that seems to have disappeared, and I don't know exactly how and why, but I remember in the war in Afghanistan, and then especially when the president was going to invade Iraq and when he did invade Iraq, there were demonstrations all over the world involving tens of millions of people, in this country, millions of people, which came to absolutely nothing. It didn't have any effect on the government's behavior. So what happens with freedom of the press here? And it's a lot. I'm putting a lot on your plate. What happens with freedom of the press, and what happens with the fact that American citizens, you know, they're not going to go in and lobby Congress, each one, but could demonstrate and assemble, and it would have an effect?
Well, those are really good questions, and they're core questions about how we can transform things today or move in that direction. On the second piece of how how to have an impact in protests. I mean, peace action certainly is involved in protests and rallies, and we do get thousands of people out there. We don't always, you know, get the kind of numbers you saw even in the run-up to the Iraq War. I mean, the one thing I would say about the run-up to the Iraq War is it's hard to transform a policy overnight, you know. The Vietnam protests went on, and there was a lot of sustained energy. And what happened with the Iraq War is you saw a lot of protests, and then once the war began, things kind of didn't maintain at the same level. So
I wonder why that was. Why do you think that was? Just as an observation on American history.
I think people felt it didn't work, and that's part of the problem, is to not look at it as failing. I mean, the Bush administration, it was a particularly unique time in the American psyche with 9/11, even though Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11,
right.
But in the public at large and politics at large, and there was an intense push for a couple months, and people interpreted that as failing, which is a natural interpretation because the Iraq War did start, and instead of keeping at it to try to bring the troops home as soon as possible and really build the peace movement, people moved on to other things. And I think there is a attention span dynamic in this era as well. So I think that's part of what's going on there. We're certainly trying to get as many people out in the street as possible. But I will say that there are other ways to have an impact. I mean, you mentioned lobbying, you know, members of Congress. I mean, people really can call, write letters. Those things do have impact if enough people do it, if the same level of people do it as are engaged in protests, if people actually talk to members of Congress and harass them at the grocery store and go to town halls. We just mobilized a lot of people to go to town halls to stop the neocons from getting rid of the Iran deal. You know, those kind of things can have an impact too. So we're working hard to get as many people in the streets as possible. We're also working through other modalities to twist the arms of members of Congress to get them to do the right thing. And I think you saw a number of members of Congress criticize this escalation, and we need more of that.
The entire American culture has moved inside, you know, with the internet. So I know people would rather click than actually go out in the weather or in put themselves in, you know, some kind of. It's not as if the government doesn't know you're doing it anyhow. I think people are intimidated. I mean, during Vietnam, the FBI was investigating people and, you know, maybe taking photographs or tapping some phones of leaders of demonstrations. But now Americans are aware of the fact that you've got the NSA and who knows who else, the FBI, with very sophisticated, very, you know, $1 trillion systems to record every keystroke that you make. And I think people are far more intimidated now than they were during the Vietnam War. I'm just using that as an example, you know.
Yeah, that could be. I mean, it's certainly outrageous what's out there in terms of the surveillance that happens in our society, and it's not getting better. I mean, there's some bills in Congress that right now, as you know, having to do with quote-unquote cyber terrorism and cyber attacks that actually expand surveillance. So those things need to be fought. I do think that, you know, it's as much people being distracted and confused, as you pointed out. Some of the complexity of these wars is just, I think, really, when I talk to people, you know, it's as much that they're confused about what the right thing to do is. They're focused on other things in their life as it is that they're intimidated. But I think all of those factors come into play in terms of causing people not to be active. But that's why we do the work we do, is to take whoever is willing to be active and to try to maximize the impact of those folks.
Mm-hmm. So If people go to your website, Peace Action West, is it peaceactionwest.org?
Well, I would suggest people go to the national office's website, peace-action.org.
Okay.
And there are ways to get active. I mean, we're pressing, for example, on this escalation. So peace-action.org is the website to go to.
Do you mind if I ask you a little bit? I mean, have you been following the players in this conflict over there? Do you? I mean, it's impossible to sum it up in just a minute or two. But who was the United States supporting, and why? And then what has happened with all these other groups? And the second part of that is, shouldn't all of these groups... So, would you, there's two wars going on at the same time. I think that's the problem. There's a civil war in Syria, at least. A civil war in Syria and a fight against this group ISIS, which seems to be lined up against almost everybody there. And then maybe you could talk a little bit about Iran's involvement in this.
Well, I think that's exactly right, and what the administration claims is that they're focused on the fight against ISIS and not Assad, and that's why it's difficult to get together the quote-unquote moderate rebels. I mean, our point of view when it comes to the groups is, for one thing, we shouldn't confuse kind of a civil society protest against the Assad regime with the civil war itself, although they may be overlapping. There's not a lot of political control over some of these fighting forces. And speaking of specific groups, what we see is that there aren't a lot of moderates that most American people would be happy backing. And what we've been willing to do over the last few months is fight alongside, ironically, the al-Nusra Front, which is an al-Qaeda affiliate. So it's kind of crazy to think that, 14 years later, when we got into this war to fight al-Qaeda, somehow now al-Qaeda is at least a tactical ally instead of the enemy. I mean, that is just mind-boggling when you talk about the various groups that are involved. So there really isn't a moderate opposition that's kind of centralized. And this is kind of a perennial problem in the sense that we were sold kind of a similar line when the so-called no-fly zone began in Libya, which ended up being a huge civil war there that deposed the Gaddafi regime and led to a lot of chaos. But we were sold at that as backing a moderate opposition. So that's obviously not what's going on in terms of the militias that are fighting each other in Syria. So I think that's a big part of the problem here. And the only solution, though, is to try to build some infrastructure for there to be a political process. And I'm not exactly sanguine about a diplomatic process to end the civil war in Syria, but it's really our only shot at stabilizing the region.
Isn't there a meeting? Aren't there meetings going on now to try to work out some kind of... I mean, I don't know if the Assad government is involved at all, but aren't there meetings going on? I can't even imagine.
There are meetings. I would characterize them as kind of, necessary throat-clearing exercises to try to start some kind of process. So you had a communique out of a meeting in Vienna last week of 17 countries saying we ought to have a diplomatic solution here. That's potentially a useful first step, but it's very much in the vein of a first step. You mentioned Iran. Iran was at the table for the first time at that meeting, and we see that as a healthy development. If you can get Russia at the table, if you can get Iran at the table, if you can get the Saudis at the table, and Turkey and the United States, and along supporting a diplomatic process where the Syrians are negotiating some kind of unity government. That's the only solution to this in the long run. Mm-hmm. Just like sitting down with the Taliban is the only solution to what's happening in Afghanistan. There's not going to be a military solution. There has to be a political solution. And, you know, it shouldn't just be the militias negotiating. You have to, you know, invite some kind of political process that puts together a governance apparatus that can work. So, you know, that's the way out of this endless military cycle.
You're listening to John Rainwater, who is the executive director of Peace Action West, which is part of Peace Action, the national group. And you've been around for a long time. The organization's been around like 50 years or something?
That's almost 60. We started this Committee for a Sane Nuclear Policy, and you were speaking of Vietnam. We were very involved in bringing the troops home from Vietnam. So we share the same deja vu that you have about these battles, but we keep plugging away to make a more peaceful foreign policy.
Well, without getting into more details, and I appreciate the amount of time that you've given us so far, but would you say that you personally and that the group itself are you a pacifist? Is the group a pacifist group? In other words, is there no way in which the United States should ever use military force anywhere for any reason?
Well, in some ways, I think the perspective is that the way that nations fight wars right now are in their self-interest, and that is not a legitimate use of violence. That theoretically, if the United Nations, for example, had some sort of force, peacekeeping force, you know, can those people shoot guns? That might be appropriate if it was truly guided by having to protect civilians. What we are concerned about is that a lot of conflicts, whether it's Libya or other conflicts, are dressed up as humanitarian interventions, mm-hmm. and they end up being the U.S. military fighting on behalf of one side in a civil war, and perhaps also looking out for some pretty narrow parochial interests, as we were talking about earlier. So none of that to us is legitimate. You know, could there theoretically be a war that's legitimate to either for self-defense or to protect people? That's a possibility, but that's not what we're seeing today in the world.
I always thought that one exception to all of this might have been Somalia. That there was a desire. Maybe it was naive, or maybe there was some agenda. I don't know, but there was an agenda. There was a desire by the president and by whoever else, it turned out to be a disaster, to send the American military in there to use force to actually feed people who were starving. I always thought Somalia was kind of a noble effort, but maybe I'm being naive.
Well, I think there's something there, and what we need is to take the United Nations or an entity like that more seriously and give them the funding to do peacekeeping and to address humanitarian crises. But, you know, the only way that's really going to work in the long run is if you create a different political culture or governance culture. And this, I recognize, sounds utopian, but mm-hmm. we have to hold the vision that's really about protecting people and not each individual nation always just trying to advance its parochial interests. If you had something like that, it would make much more sense for the United Nations to respond to something like that than to have NATO, for example, right, over in Afghanistan, quote-unquote, rebuilding Afghanistan. Why is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization rebuilding Afghanistan? It doesn't make a lot of sense. There may be need to address some of these situations through multilateral efforts, but that should be part of a unified government effort at the UN level is the way to think of it, I think.
That may be a long way off considering the behavior and the attitudes of most countries in the world, certainly our country. One last question is, and, you know, this would be for a certain purpose. One of the reasons why the war in Vietnam didn't fare very well after a while was because people were being drafted against their will to go fight in a war, which people began to understand was a wrong war, immoral, impractical, and everything else wrong with it. There have been occasional attempts to restore the draft. In other words, if there wasn't a volunteer professional army from which actually a lot of people are making hundreds of billions of dollars, you know, contractors and mercenaries and everything. If there was just a regular army where people were drafted again and everybody equally, well, it's never equal. Look at George W. Bush. But if everybody was equally subject to fighting in a war, which didn't make any sense to begin with, maybe that would change things.
I think there's a lot of logic in that, and there have been efforts in Congress along those lines, kind of motivated by not at all building forces up, but to have it be a shared sacrifice for the country so that we think a little bit more before we go into some of these wars. It would be something that we would hesitate to support, even though, you know, it's being backed by some pretty progressive people like Charlie Rangel in Congress, because we don't have a government that is sensible about sending its people into war. Mm-hmm. So it's hard for us to support something like that, but completely accept the logic of what you're talking about.
Okay, well, thank you for spending so much time to discuss this. And John Rainwater, who is the executive director of Peace Action West. And again, where should people go if they want to get involved and donate and have some impact aside from just wishing it wasn't that way?
That's right. www.peace-action.org, and we're at Peace Action on Twitter as well. So it'd be great if folks could join in the efforts here. We need to move the needle on U.S. foreign policy.
Okay. Thank you once again. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. This is Mike Fader, and we are doing our show, The Turning Point. This show will be slightly abbreviated today, obviously, and we will be back next week.
It was back in 1942, I was a member of a good platoon. We were on maneuvers in Louisiana one night by the light of the moon. The captain told us to ford a river, that's how it all begun. We were knee-deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. The sergeant said, sir, are you sure this is the best way back to the base? Sergeant, go on, I forded this river about a mile above this place. It'll be a little soggy, but just keep slogging, we'll soon be on dry ground. We were waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Well, the sergeant said, sir, with all this equipment, no man will be able to swim. Sergeant, don't be a nervous Nelly, the captain said to him. All we need is a little determination, men, follow me, I'll lead on. We were neck deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. All at once, the moon clouded over, we heard a gurgling cry. A few seconds later, the captain's helmet was all that floated by. The sergeant said, turn around, men, I'm in charge from now on. And we just made it out of the big muddy with the captain dead and gone. We stripped and dived and found his body stuck in the old quicksand. I guess he didn't know that the water was deeper than the place he'd once before been. Another stream had joined the big muddy about a half mile from where we'd gone. We were lucky to escape from the big muddy when the big fool said to push on. Well, I'm not going to point anymore, and I'll leave that for yourself. Maybe you're still walking, you're still talking, you'd like to keep your health. But every time I read the paper, them old feelings come on. We're waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep, neck deep, soon even a tall man will be over his head. We're waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on.